The Big Law Business Podcast is brought to you by Epic. Stay ahead of the curve with Epic. Gain more traction for the critical legal tasks in front of you today and those just around the corner. Epic delivers expert matter handling along with the accuracy and speed you rely on to outperform your competition. Epic is a global leader in the legal services industry. Epic subject matter experts and technologies create efficiency through expertise and deliver confidence to high-performing clients around the world. Learn more at epicglobal.com. That's epicglobal.com.
Welcome to Big Law Business. I'm Josh Block. On today's podcast, how Richard Nixon's years in New York working as a big law partner helped him become president. The years in between 1962 and 1968 are referred to as Richard Nixon's wilderness years. These are the years after he lost the race to become governor of California and before the 1968 presidential election. Scholars and historians haven't spent as much time exploring this period, and because Nixon spent these years as a partner in a large New York City law firm, it was a perfect topic for a legal journalist to explore. Our guest today is Victor Lee. Victor spends his days covering the business of law and legal technology for the ABA Journal, and his new book is called Nixon in New York. I started by asking him about what drew him to covering this period of Nixon's life.
You know, I found that the biographies that have been written about Nixon, they talked a little bit about what happened during his so-called wilderness years, you know, when he was between jobs, I guess, so to speak. But I wanted to learn more about what it was like with him as a practicing lawyer, which is what he did for most of that time. He was a lawyer on Wall Street as a senior partner at the firm that became known as Nixon Mudge. And so I wanted to learn more about just what he was like as a lawyer, because I think we know plenty about what he was like as a politician. Plenty of people have written about what he's like as a person. And many scholars have tried to figure out what made him tick. What made him do the things that he did. But I didn't see too much written about just what he was like as an actual lawyer. And so that was kind of what drew me to writing this book. Just was wanting to find out more about that time period.
Do you have a sense of why that was largely left aside? Why historians didn't delve into it?
You look about all the things that he accomplished in his life. I mean, president for 6 years, I guess, because he had to resign obviously in the middle of his second term. But he won his second term, 49 state landslide, one of the biggest electoral victories that we've ever seen. He accomplished so much as president, and then even going back to his time as vice president, as senator, as congressman. Going up to his early life where he grew up dirt poor, not even being able to afford, little firecrackers that you could buy at a dime store, not even being able to afford that and then reaching the pinnacle of power. So I can kind of understand why that time period, just kind of pales in comparison to what he did before and afterward. Cause naturally we're drawn to stories about people in power, people who accomplished a lot, and obviously as a president, someone, especially with his profile, he's somebody that if you had to prioritize, it would probably make sense to focus on his White House years as opposed to what he was doing in private practice. But that being said, I think there was a lot of stuff that happened when he was a lawyer that is worth looking at and was worth writing about, and really kind of explain a lot about how he got to where he did, which was the White House in 1968.
So why was a New York City law firm the perfect place for a former politician with presidential aspirations to sort of bide his time and eventually launch a campaign for president?
It was common for politicians to go to Wall Street, especially after they lost the big election, which he did in 1960 by the very narrowest of margins to Kennedy. Dewey went to Wall Street after he left the governor's mansion in New York. Started a very successful firm that obviously, eventually made history as one of the, perhaps the largest ever law firm failure a few years ago. And, Wendell Willkie went to Wall Street as well. you know, several other like big name politicians like that. Going to Wall Street was kind of seen as what a defeated has-been does, because you're out of the public eye. You don't have an electoral base to kind of help build for like another major election. So him going to New York was seen by a lot of people as, okay, he's done, he's finished, he's never going to run for office again, especially considering how he left the political arena with his, after losing the gubernatorial race in California, a race that he really should have won, and then giving a very nasty, self-pitying, spoil sport kind of press conference afterward.
I leave you gentlemen now, and you will now write it, you will interpret it, that's your right. But as I leave you, I want you to know, just think how much you're going to be missing. You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore. Because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference, and I hope that what I have said today will at least...
Going to Wall Street kind of allowed him to kind of cultivate other parts of his image and burnish himself as someone who, you know, was a statesman, someone who was, you know, a respected elder statesman, even though he was still very young. And law firms, you know, are a very good base for certain things like getting access to deep-pocketed clients, traveling the world, having very young, very smart people to help with his work. And so, you know, it ended up being like kind of the ideal spot for him, because he didn't, you know, he was able to kind of stay out of the fights he didn't want to get to, but he was able to kind of still weigh in on issues from time to time while bringing business to his firm and helping the firm develop and make more money.
Was New York the place, or did the opportunity at Mudge Rose present itself? Was he considering other firms?
He really was stung by what happened in the gubernatorial race. It was not a close race. He got beaten pretty badly by a guy that, you know, wasn't considered to be a very strong incumbent governor.
It's Pat Brown, right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously looking back now, you know, he's a giant, but back then, you know, compared to Nixon, I mean, Nixon had never lost a race in his life. You know, he come within like a few states of winning the presidency. So that, you know, that should have been a cakewalk for him, but he was really hurt by that, by losing that race. And so going to New York allowed him to get away from that. But then also, you know, there was also the cover of him saying that, okay, well, I can't be a candidate here because Nelson Rockefeller is in charge of New York. And Nelson Rockefeller at that time was probably his biggest rival in the Republican Party. So going to New York allowed him to get access to the firms that he wanted to work with. And Mudge ended up being, you know, the best choice for him because, you know, they desperately needed someone of his caliber, someone that could bring in business, someone who could call people and have, you know, that call immediately returned, and someone that could serve as sort of the face of the firm.
And how much on his mind is that I'll be running again when he joins Mudge?
It was pretty much something that was on his mind from the beginning. I mean, he never really gave up his dream of being president. I mean, yeah, maybe he knew in the back of his mind that it was going to be very, very difficult for him to recover from what happened in 60 and 62. And he definitely understood that he was facing a long, tough road back. I mean, you know, at that point, you know, JFK is still alive and looking like he's going to easily win re-election in 64. So, and then you never know what could happen after that. So if it weren't running for president, he would still want to do something related to public service, serving in the White House, serving in the, you know, as maybe a Secretary of State. So that was still very much on his mind. And one of the reasons why he wanted to go to a law firm was that, you know, because he had offers from various universities, various boards. I think he even had an offer from Major League Baseball to be commissioner, which that would have been really interesting. But you know, he couldn't still do politics if he did that, because he'd have to, you know, especially if you're in baseball, you know, you can't, you know, you can't wade into, senatorial races or campaign for people if you're running the major leagues. So that was still very much on his mind, he had a very saying that he was fond of, that, you know, he liked being a gladiator in the arena. And so if he couldn't be the main guy, he could still be, you know, involved. And so that was sort of what he was thinking, that being at a law firm would allow him to still weigh in on political races as much as he wanted to, it would allow him to kind of stay away from local politics and, you know, state politics that he didn't really care for. And he'd be able to go abroad and meet with heads of state, meet with you know, important business people, you know, from other countries, and show that you know, he had understanding of foreign policy and demonstrate his diplomatic skills.
And did the firm know that's what he was thinking? Did they care? And frankly, was that like partially what they wanted?
Well, there's a very interesting story that came out where they're on the golf course talking about, you know, just what their plans are and whatnot. And Nixon hasn't gotten the offer yet at this point to come aboard. And so one of the partners just straight out asks him, like, you know, are you still going to be running for president? Because, you know, at your last firm, they told us that, you know, you spent most of your time running for governor. You didn't spend a whole lot of time generating business or representing clients or whatnot. That's not really going to fly here. You know, we expect you to, you know, if you're going to be with the firm, we expect you to be with the firm. Obviously, you know, if you still want to, you know, involve yourself in politics and whatnot, that's fine, because that brings prestige to the firm. It gets the firm's name in the papers. You know, it's Richard Nixon's firm. It's, you know, whenever anyone interviews him, they have to put that he's a member of the firm. And so Nixon gave a very kind of cagey answer, like, well, if you knew anything about politics, you would know that a politician never gives up his base. And they took that to mean, well, you know, because he left California, that would mean that he's not going to be able to run for anything anymore. So they kind of took him at his word that he was done. But you know, in the back of their mind, they kind of knew that, you know, he still wanted to be actively involved. But that was part of the appeal of having him, because that way he could still be, you know, he could serve as a good face of the firm, someone who could be a good spokesperson and whatnot. And whenever he asked his partners for, you know, things like, you know, an increased staff to help him with his political work, or to hire like speech writers, or to hire, you know, I mean, what, you know, why would a managing partner or a senior partner need a speech writer unless you're, you know, especially for politics. But they indulged him, and they let him do, you know, they let him have what he wanted. Whenever he wanted to take time off from the firm to campaign for Republicans across the country, you know, in the 66 midterms or in the 64 presidential election, when they were looking at with Goldwater at the top of the ticket, you know, they gave him the time off.
The man who earned and proudly carries the title of Mr. Conservative, and he is the man who, after the greatest campaign in history, will be Mr. President, Barry Goldwater.
So they definitely knew what they were getting into. It was just, I mean, maybe they didn't think that he was going to, you know, run for something immediately or, you know, even win. But they definitely kind of felt like, okay, well, we can get a benefit here.
Tell me a little bit more about Mudge Rose. I've looked at in the early rankings that the American Lawyer did, they were in the top 50. I've seen some other things that had them in that top 50 area. Where would they be today? And we can get into what happened. They're not around anymore, obviously. But so where were they then, and what was the firm like?
So they'd always kind of been in that tier of firms that was like, you know, if you have Cravath at the very top, and you have, you know, your firms like that, like your Davis Polks and whatnot, kind of in that top tier, they were always a tier below those firms. So they had trouble attracting like the creme de la creme as far as law students, as far as, you know, lawyers and whatnot. I mean, you know, they still did pretty well for themselves. They were they managed to get a lot of good people there, and people that ended up, you know, a lot of people that ended up gravitating toward Nixon. But I mean, one of his closest, probably his closest friend at the firm, Leonard Garment, who ended up being a very prominent official in the White House administration, you know, White House counsel, and holding a variety of jobs under Nixon. You know, he graduated from Brooklyn Law School, which, you know, back then, like, you know, most of the law firms were, you know, wouldn't even look at a guy with that kind of a resume. You know, they were looking for Harvard, Yale, or Columbia. You know, maybe even some of the so-called, you know, lesser Ivies. But for a Brooklyn Law School, you know, guy to ascend to that level, you know, but that kind of showed you what kind of, you know, that where the firm was, that they weren't fighting for the very, 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 very top of the heap as far as law students go, but they were getting like a lot of the, you know, people from like these these mid-tier schools that would go and some of them would go and do it very well for them and prove themselves, and Garment was one of them. They were a firm that when Nixon joined, they were sort of in decline because they had had some generational changes and whatnot, and some institutional rot had set in. And so they were looking for a guy that could come and just kind of be a rainmaker for the firm, be a public face, be someone that could open doors for them and whatnot. And you know, they had acquired a very unflattering nickname on Wall Street. They were known as Mudge, Sludge, Fudge, and Won't Budge. Kind of playing on the reputation as being kind of stuck in the mud. And so Nixon brought them out of that, and they did very well under him.
Like he was getting them business right away, right?
Yeah, billable hours shot up. Whatever the metric for profits for partner back then, that increased as well. So he brought in clients on his own. Like Pepsi came in with him because they owed him a lot of favors over the years. Their CEO was good friends with Nixon, so he brought in like some clients from his Los Angeles firm as well. So I mean, he's basically kind of what law firms would be looking for today. You know, a guy with a name, a guy with a book of business, a guy who could bring in more business.
He talked about his approach to getting new business by spending time with clients, but never directly asking for it, and saying that you just spend time with clients and they'll eventually come to you. That sounds like something that's easy to say for a former vice president, right? tell me about what he did.
Yeah, but that's easy to say if you're Richard Nixon. I mean, it's probably not. You know, if you or I were in that position, you know, we wouldn't just be able to just,
Or your average partner at a major law firm.
Yeah. I don't think we would just be able to go to a cocktail party and be like, "All right, come to me." So he definitely had the luxury of being, someone with a name, someone with a cachet, someone who was very, someone who people really wanted to meet and wanted to talk to. But his approach to business was, kind of what he was saying, there's an anecdote in the book where he talks about how the best way to get business is just be a friend to these people, just talk to them, just get to know them, but don't like solicit them actively for business. Just let them know about, who you are, what your expertise is, what you're good at, that kind of stuff, and then they'll come to you when they need you. He was a little less charitable in private. There's a quote in here that all he has to do is just tell a bunch of idiots what they want to hear, read things that they could have found out in the newspaper, and he gets paid for it.
Right. I never realized how easy it is to make money or something.
Yeah.
Was that, yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, so that's sort of where his head was at as far as his job and his role on Wall Street. Not to say that he didn't do a good job or that he was supposed to do for his law firm, but there was a kind of cynical aspect of it too.
So in getting ready to talk to you, I looked at Leonard Garment's interview with Charlie Rose from the late 90s when his book came out.
Leonard Garment has written a book called Crazy Rhythm. It is about his life. It is about his career as a lawyer. It is also about his relationship with Richard Nixon. Crazy Rhythm.
And that seems like such an interesting relationship. Leonard Garment was Jewish. He was from Brooklyn. He was a Democrat. Like you mentioned, he went to Brooklyn Law School. Tell me about this relationship between the two men.
Garment was one of their stars. He was a guy, he kind of fell into law accidentally. He was, law was never his passion. Music was his passion.
Well, let's see. I was a sort of a boy klezmer jazz player.
In Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn, right. Grew up in a neighborhood, a jazz rich neighborhood.
He was a very good clarinet player, and he played in several like jazz bands during his life. But when he was young, when he was concentrating on, he actually played with some well-known people and whatnot. He was actually in a band with Alan Greenspan at one point. But once he realized that he wasn't going to, there was only so far he was going to get in music, he wasn't going to, be like Duke Ellington or anything, he decided to go into law. And, he was a working class kid from Brooklyn. He went to Brooklyn Law. He was Jewish, and at that point, Wall Street firms didn't really hire people like that, especially Jewish people. But what happened was the recruiting partner at at Mudge liked him and saw something in him and decided to take a chance on him. And so by the time Nixon got there, Garment had already done pretty well for himself. He was a partner. He had handled some of the firm's biggest litigation matters, but he was bored. He was good. He was good at his job. He got satisfaction out of it, but he wanted to do something else. And when he saw Nixon, he saw his chance to do something more important with his life. He was someone who was a Democrat. He admitted to Nixon that he held a fundraiser for Bobby Kennedy in his house at one point, which you would think that would have disqualified him from Nixon's inner circle, at once. But Nixon, took a liking to him. I think Nixon saw a lot of himself in Garment, in a sense, because Garment had accomplished what Garment had succeeded in Wall Street. He had overcome a humble beginning to get the acceptance and get the respect from the well-heeled folks on Wall Street and become a very powerful person. So I think he admired that, and I think he kind of wanted to accomplish that himself, provided that he didn't become president. I think it was a case where they kind of saw a useful ally in one another. They did develop a very strong rapport for one another. I don't know if they were, I wouldn't call them best friends. I mean, it's kind of hard to gauge just how Nixon felt about most people, let alone people that he worked with.
Garment even passes on the opportunity to argue before the Supreme Court in 1966, giving the case to Nixon because he thought it would benefit Nixon politically.
Yeah, I mean, and that was surprising to me. I mean, just because I didn't know much about the case before I started writing this. For most people, I mean, that's like the golden ticket. You get a chance to argue a case before the Supreme Court, you do it. I mean, that can make your career. That's something that no lawyer in their right mind would turn down. But Garment figured, okay, well, this will be good for me, but it would be better for him.
Mr. Nixon.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. I believe that the fundamental issue here cannot be determined unless there is a judgment with regard to the facts. There has been discussion.
And if it's better for him, then it's better for me in the long run, because then he'll remember me. He'll take me along to Washington if and when he wins the presidency. And that's pretty much what happened. I mean, with a few bumps in the road and whatnot. But and that was sort of the attitude the law firm took with Nixon as a whole. Like, if it's good for Nixon, it's good for the firm.
I don't want to get too much into the particulars of the case, but it's worth noting that Nixon is representing the family suing a corporation for a violation of privacy law. He went up against a lawyer from Cravath who was representing Life magazine, and by all accounts, he did a great job on this case.
Yeah, I mean, the consensus at the time was that he did a good job. I mean, he was very inexperienced. He had never argued in a case at the appellate level before, so this was this was the first time he'd ever even argued before appellate judges. I mean, I don't know if he did moot appellate arguments in law school, but that might have been the last time he had to do something like that. The idea that you would turn your case over to a guy making his debut, having never even argued, even before circuit court, is pretty stunning. But Nixon, was a guy that if he put his mind to something, he could generally accomplish it. And so he memorized the entire case file. He learned as much as he could about the law. And I mean, like you say, he represented a married couple that was suing Time Life.
Part of the Life article. Mr. Justice Portis, the reading of the Life article can lead to no conclusion except that those individuals who go to the playing at the Barrymore Theater at that time, would see a reenactment of an incident which happened to the Hills. A reading of the article.
But that also kind of played into his general dislike toward the media and how he felt like he had been victimized by the media over the years, treated very unfairly. And so this was kind of like his way of, I don't want to say getting revenge on the media, but definitely kind of getting back at them, while also kind of casting himself as a defender for the little guy. Like, here he is sticking up for this poor family that got that their lives were absolutely ruined by Time Life because they just didn't care about them, and nothing was standing in the way of a good story as far as they were concerned. And so that would be a very compelling narrative that he would want, if and when he decided to run for president again, which at that point was already a done deal.
At some point, he commits to running for president. You had mentioned that the firm okayed him hiring a staff, which is interesting. I wonder how they billed, right? Like, who paid for that? You know, the firm just picked it up. But among the staff that were at Mudge Rose that were not lawyers, right, were Pat Buchanan, William Sapphire. Tell me about this, how this worked.
At first, it just started off as like a bare bones operation. He had some money. The firm. Like they would support some of the some members of his staff, if they could also use them for other things, but he also had like an outside group that was in charge of like raising money for campaign expenses and for various other things that he would need over the years, and so they would take care of some of it too. He decided that he needed people to help him ultimately become president. So the first step in that was really to hire like a top-notch writing staff, and so he wanted people that could quickly research facts for him, draw up speeches and whatnot. So he hired Pat Buchanan, William Sapphire, and Ray Price, who all went on to a much greater fame as well. And he had like several lawyers in the firm helping him as well. John Sears was a big get for him. Sears is a guy who he would also go on to like greater fame and whatnot. Running Reagan's campaign in '80. Obviously they all had their law firm tasks and their legal practice and whatnot. But whenever like a political issue came up, they would help him out, write a speech for him, or research issues for him, or research the law to see if they could set up certain organizations or certain do certain types of fundraising and whatnot. So they definitely came in handy in that sense.
Obviously Nixon wins. What happens to Mudge Rose after that? How does his presidency affect the firm? And then I guess going forward, then how does Watergate affect the firm?
At first, it was very good for the firm. They were Richard Nixon's firm. They were a firm that was very well known. Now they had very powerful friends. Because one person whose name we haven't mentioned was John Mitchell, who came to the firm via a merger. And he ended up becoming attorney general after running Nixon's presidential campaign. So you have the president, you have the attorney general, it's two former name partners of the firm. That's pretty good. those are pretty good friends to have, especially if you have a lot of business dealing, if you have a lot of business before the government, if you have a lot of regulatory matters and whatnot. So a lot of business flowed to the law firm, especially right after Nixon was elected. It did not work out for the firm because, obviously their relationship with Nixon got put under a microscope. They had a couple controversies with regards to clients who, people questioned whether they were trying to use the firm to get undue influence, unduly influence Nixon or Mitchell and whatnot. But otherwise, it was a good problem to have, being perceived for rightly or wrongly as having access to the highest echelons of power. It's never a bad thing. But then when Watergate hits, obviously that reflects badly on the firm in a sense, because they're associated with Nixon, but also Mitchell had come back to the firm after Nixon's first term had ended. So he was back at the firm and he was being groomed to take over.
And he's implicated.
Right? He goes to jail eventually. And so that reflects very badly on the firm. And also, this is a generational issue because Nixon, obviously, you talk about his politics, talk about his ideology or lack thereof, but he represented a certain type of person, and a lot of young lawyers, especially people coming out of law school, didn't necessarily want to be associated with that. So they found themselves kind of hurt by their association with Nixon because of Watergate, but also hurt like with law students coming out of school, and so as a result, they kind of fall into another decline, which they ended up pulling themselves out of. But then in the '90s, they go into another decline, and that takes the firm down.
As you know, I looked up the account of the collapse of the New York Times, and there was an article called "The Mudge Rose Firm Enters the Tar Pit of Legal History."
That's a good headline.
Yeah, it's a good headline, but reading this article, it was eerie how much the article could have been about Duane LaBeouf.
Yeah.
you know, it was almost the same article with different numbers and different people. So talk about the I guess what eventually happened. I know that goes a little bit beyond the scope of your book, but what then happens to Mudge Rose?
They had a long career after the Watergate that so you can't blame that necessarily on Nixon. So in the early 80s, they actually did really well. When that inaugural AM Law 50 rankings came out, they were in the top 50. They're sort of at the bottom of the top 50, well behind, you know, your Cravats and your Baker and McKenzie's and whatnot, but still established as one of the top firms in the country. But a couple things kind of hurt them. Earlier, I had mentioned Mitchell. Mitchell's law firm had been a specialist in municipal bonds. That was one of the reasons why he was so appealing to the firm and also to Nixon as a campaign manager, because he had relationships with government officials all over the country. And so when Mudge acquired that firm, you know, the municipal bond practice continued to thrive and continued to do very well, to the point where they were probably a little too heavy in that area. And so in the 90s, when the early 90s recession hit, that killed the bond market. And so that hurt their overall practice. They were too heavily focused on one area. I mean, we saw that with, I think, Thatcher Prophet and some of those other firms that died because of the they were too heavy into the mortgage-backed securities prior to the last recession. So that kind of hurt. Also, it's a lot of the same things that plague a lot of firms. You know, they have partners who make a lot of money but don't do a lot. Other partners get jealous. Other people, you know, are like, how come this guy's making so much money and not doing anything, but we're bringing all the work and not getting as much. So, you know, one thing that article mentioned and whatnot was that, you know, when times are good, money papers over all these problems. No one really cares as long as everyone's getting paid. But when things are bad, that's when you find out, okay, who is it that you can trust and who is it that you can't. So once things got bad, you know, a lot of partners started looking for greener pastures. A bunch of people defected. And that's generally how these things happen. I mean, with Dewey, it was the same thing. You know, a bunch of partners defected. All of a sudden, you know, the partners that aren't leaving, then look at that and sort of think, okay, well, how come we're still here and they're leaving? So do they know something? So then they start to leave, and then it becomes kind of a never-ending cycle until there's nothing left. And that's sort of what happened with Mudge. At the end of the day, there, you know, too many people, you know, too many partners left, and they couldn't replace them. And once the money dried up, then that exposed a lot of the underlying issues that had been kind of buried by the firm for a long time.
Bringing it back to the book, and I'm holding it in my hand. It's, you know, 350 pages. When you think about the big takeaway from this, it seems that, you know, these years that have been talked about as wilderness years, in large part, are really these years that helped him win the White House, because he spent the time at this firm, because he made these connections. Is that the way you see it?
I mean, I definitely think personally, it was a very like fulfilling time for him, as far as like getting him ready to run, getting him ready to run, kind of regardless of where the country was. Absolutely, you know, like, because one problem that had always plagued him in the past, especially in 1960, was that he had always kind of done things himself. He'd always run the campaign on his own. He'd always like kind of done things by the seat of his pants, taking on like even like small tasks, but then also, you know, like micromanaging things and then just kind of really wearing himself out at the end. I mean, like in 60, a big reason why he lost was because, you know, he insisted on campaigning in all 50 states. Like, who does that? You know, I mean, nobody campaigns in all 50 states. So going to the firm kind of allowed him to kind of delegate more. And he finally had people around him that understood politics the way he did, but also understood how to sell himself. So as far as like helping him, putting him in a position to where he could run again, absolutely, the firm probably played a vital role.
Thanks to Victor Lee for being our guest. His book is Nixon in New York: How Wall Street Helped Richard Nixon Win the White House. For more news and information about the legal industry and the business of law, check out biglawbusiness.com. If you'd like to contact us, our email address is biglawbusiness@bloomberglaw.com. Follow Big Law Business on Twitter @biglawbiz. Follow me on Twitter @joshblocknyc. Follow Victor Lee @victorlee2000. Lee is spelled L-I. We'll be back soon with a new podcast. Subscribe to make sure that you don't miss it.
The Big Law Business Podcast is brought to you by Epic. Stay ahead of the curve with Epic. Gain more traction for the critical legal tasks in front of you today and those just around the corner. Epic delivers expert matter handling along with the accuracy and speed you rely on to outperform your competition. Epic is a global leader in the legal services industry. Epic subject matter experts and technologies create efficiency through expertise and deliver confidence to high-performing clients around the world. Learn more at epicglobal.com. That's EPIQ global.com.